Hello, I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This is the New Yorker Hour. We're starting off today with the August 19th, 2019 issue, What Toni Morrison Understood About Hate. In December 1993, Toni Morrison, the author, flew to Stockholm to deliver the lecture required of those awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. Her subject was the power of language. Words, she said, have the capacity to liberate, empower, imagine, and heal, but cruelly employed, they can render the suffering of millions mute. Morrison was unsparing in her depiction of people who would use language to evil ends. Pointing to infantile heads of state who speak only to those who obey in order to force obedience, she warned of the virulence of the demagogue. Oppressive language does more than represent violence, she said. It is violence. Morrison died on August 5th at the age of 88. Her novels and essays exploring black communities with intimacy and imagination took in the legacy of slavery, the rejection of Reconstruction, the brutalities of Jim Crow, the whole of American history. Even in her final days, her political sense remained unerring. Just days after the 2016 election, writing in this magazine, she sensed the arrival of a troubling era, one centered on a callous and cunning confidence man. Quote, so scary are the consequences of a collapse of white privilege that many Americans have flocked to a political platform that supports and translates violence against the defenseless as strength. These people are not so much angry as terrified with the kind of terror that makes knees tremble. On election day, how eagerly so many white voters, both the poorly educated and the well-educated, embraced the shame and fear sowed by Donald Trump, the candidate whose company has been sued by the Justice Department for not renting apartments to black people, the candidate who questioned whether Barack Obama was born in the United States and who seemed to condone the beating of a Black Lives Matter protester at a campaign rally, the candidate who kept black workers off the floors of his casinos, the candidate who was beloved by David Duke and endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan, close quote. Donald Trump is far from the first president to express rank prejudice. Thomas Jefferson, in Notes on the State of Virginia, maintained that black men and women had a very strong and disagreeable odor. Woodrow Wilson screened the Klan-glorifying film The Birth of a Nation at the White House. As we learned recently, Ronald Reagan, in a telephone conversation with Richard Nixon, referred to Africans as monkeys, and so on. But what is unique about Trump, at least in modern times, is the extent to which bigotry is his principal means of rousing support. Trump backers who aren't drawn to his bigotry chose to tolerate it. Ours is a country that could elect a black president preaching unity. It's also a country where tens of millions of Americans continue to say that they will vote for a man whose platform is nativism and division. There is a calculation behind the bigotry. Trump recognized that Obama's ascent to the White House in 2008 was met by a powerful racist reaction. Hate crimes and white supremacist groups proliferated, as did threats against the president's person. And so Trump began his political career deploying the language of conspiracy theory. First as a candidate and then as a president, he spoke of Mexican rapists, of caravans filled with encroaching aliens. He directed invective at African Americans, Muslims, women and immigrants, and at legislators of color. Drawing on a long and toxic tradition, he has put forward a form of white identity politics in which violent language gives license to violent acts. Such language is hardly a matter of thoughtless improvisation. Recently, The Times reported that the Trump campaign has seized on the imagery of invasion, one of the president's favorite descriptions of immigration, as a theme for its Facebook ads. Such language is in sync with that of the mass shooter in El Paso, who, before killing 22 people and wounding many more in a Walmart, appears to have issued a manifesto warning that this attack is a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. And, as the civil rights leader Brian Stevenson says, the insistence on unfettered gun ownership is a core tenet of white identity politics. Although the solidity of the president's base should not be underestimated, a sense of alarm is growing. The clerical leaders of the Washington National Cathedral, where the funerals of Presidents Eisenhower, Ford, Reagan, and Bush took place, gave voice to that alarm last week. Quote, "When such violent, dehumanizing words come from the President of the United States, they are a clarion call to give cover to white supremacists who consider people of color a subhuman infestation in America," close quote. They wrote that in an official statement. Violent words lead to violent actions, and then they asked, "When does silence become complicity? What will it take for us all to say with one voice that we have had enough?" The question is less about the president's sense of decency, but of ours. After the recent massacres in El Paso and in Dayton, White House aides evidently decided that Trump needed to dial back his rhetoric. In a brief speech, he denounced white supremacy, but with the vacant effect of a hostage reading for the camera. Liberated from this chore, he soon regained his usual temper. Visiting the bereaved in Texas and Ohio, he found the time to lambast local officials, along with sleepy Joe Biden, the lamestream media, and other customary targets. In 1932, Franklin Delano Roosevelt characterized the presidency as preeminently a place of moral leadership. Trump, by contrast, once told his circle of advisors that they should think of each presidential day as an episode in a television show in which he vanquishes rivals. In the Trump Show, which will soon be up for renewal, immigrants, Muslims, and people of color are regularly cast as the villains. Toni Morrison approached the enduring phenomenon of American bigotry and nativism from many angles, but she had a clear sense that the critical function of racism was distraction. "Racism keeps you from doing your work," she said. "It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being. Somebody says you have no language and you spend 20 years proving that you do. Somebody says your head isn't shaped properly, so you have scientists working on the fact that it is. Somebody says that you have no art, so you dredge that up. Somebody says that you have no kingdoms, and you dredge that up. None of that is necessary. There will always be one more thing." This article by David Remnick. He's been the editor of The New Yorker since 1998 and a staff writer since 1992. From TheNewYorker.com and dated August 18, 2019, here is daily comment by Bernard Avishai. "By barring two congresswomen, Trump and Netanyahu set a trap for Democrats. For those unable to decide whether Donald Trump acts as a shrewd political tactician or with mere crude improvisation, the tweet dare that he sent to Benjamin Netanyahu last Thursday will not settle the matter. It was perhaps nothing more than base animus aimed at Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, who are not only the House's first Muslim women, but who embody the educated, cosmopolitan, minority female insurgent America that Trump cannot abide. But in depicting them as anti-Semites, they hate Israel and all Jewish people," he tweeted, and thus prompting the Netanyahu government to bar their entry to Israel and causing virtually the entire Democratic caucus to rally to their defense, "Trump seems to have launched a plot against America that even Philip Roth could not conceive. First, he evokes an Israel that is a model for the kind of tough, traditional, populist, wall-building nation that he thinks America should notionally aspire to. He coddles the right-wing Netanyahu-led forces that are committed to this hard nationalism and are, at best, cavalier about minority rights and democratic norms. And at rallies, he hammers away at the alleged anti-Semitism of prominent blacks, Hispanics, Muslims, and others, and suggests that anti-Semites are the true face of the Democratic Party. The hope, it seems, is to spur Jewish voters and contributors, and more suburban voters skeptical of radicals and evangelicals who revere the children of Israel, to abandon or further scorn the Democratic Party in favor of Trump's GOP. It would be comforting to think that this plot will fail, but so far, deliberately or inadvertently, major characters are playing to form. Netanyahu has continued to pay lip service to congressional bipartisanship, but he has gravitated openly toward the Republican Party, at least since the beginning of the Obama administration. Rather than emphasizing an Israeli and American partnership based on shared democratic values, and correspondingly dealing seriously with legitimate Palestinian demands for sovereign territory and civil rights, Netanyahu has stressed Israeli military muscle in a neighborhood polarized by Islamist radicalism and Iran. At the same time, he denies that Israeli policy has ever exacerbated those dangers. For Netanyahu, it is axiomatic that the strong survive, that free enterprise makes you rich enough to be strong, and that Jewish orthodoxy engenders social cohesion and military solidarity. In this view of the world, there is little room for Arabs or any non-Jews. This militant, vigilant Israel resonates with Trumpian Republicans. For them, being pro-Israel internationally is akin to supporting unlimited gun rights domestically, a component of what they take to be their defense of civilizational liberty. And Netanyahu reciprocates the love. He is obviously pitching more to the evangelical chorus than to Zabar's shoppers on the Upper West Side. At a Christians United for Israel annual conference in Washington in 2017, he said, "You stand with us because you stand with yourselves, because we represent that common heritage of freedom that goes back thousands of years." Netanyahu plays his part finally because, like Trump, he has his eye on re-election. Having failed to form a coalition government in May, he will face the voters again on September 17th. The left's decline and the rise of religious nationalism both play to his advantage, but many voters have grown weary of Netanyahu, who has been in office longer than any other Israeli prime minister. A cloud of corruption and the prospect of criminal trials hang over his head. If he again wins a slender victory, he will need to find coalition partners on the right who are willing to pass legislation that will disempower the Supreme Court and keep him out of prison. The price he seems willing to pay is support for legislation from the settler parties that would annex even more land in the West Bank. Netanyahu hopes that by showing Israelis that he has an ultra-special relationship with Trump, they will think of him yet again as the indispensable man. To this end, he is counting on Trump's giving him a more or less free hand with annexation. Indeed, Trump's ambassador to Israel has broadly hinted that the United States will pose no opposition to such a move. Some say that Trump's tweet bullied Netanyahu into acting against the congresswomen, acting against his own better judgment. It is true that Ron Dermer, Netanyahu's ambassador to Washington, had initially announced that Congress would not deny entry to any member of Congress. Then Trump urged Netanyahu not to show great weakness. But Dermer and Netanyahu were not disingenuous in saying that Israel had not capitulated to Trump so much as enforced its own laws. Indeed, in 2017, Netanyahu's government passed legislation barring anyone supporting the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, the BDS movement, which the congresswomen with qualifications do. Since at least 2010, when Noam Chomsky was denied entry to Israel, Netanyahu's governments have been selectively barring people they didn't like from hanging around the West Bank. It seems truer to say that Netanyahu would have been willing to make a grudging show of tolerance toward the two congresswomen, if only as a sop to AIPAC-supporting Democrats, a bipartisan group of 72 members of Congress visited Israel earlier this month. But he was not prepared to do so in opposition to Trump. The codependency between them is ever more naked. Each offers the other a measure of legitimacy in his respective base. This time, Trump held the leash. He gave a little tug via Twitter, and Netanyahu heeled. Alas, Tlaib and Omar are playing their roles as well, not simply because of loose talk all about the Benjamins, but more substantively because of their vague endorsements of BDS, which can be effectively exploited by Trump. Both now associate with the movement, though each tried to fudge this somewhat during their respective campaigns. BDS calls for, among other things, a wholesale boycott of Israel's apartheid regime, complicit Israeli sporting, cultural, and economic institutions, and all Israeli and international companies engaged in violations of Palestinian human rights. Thomas Friedman, writing in the New York Times, laments especially that Omar, who represents the district in Minnesota where he grew up, has not been building bridges between its Muslims and Jews. The BDS movement, whose most prominent leader is the Qatar-born Palestinian engineer Omar Barghouti, who lives in the Israeli Arab town of Acre, was educated at Columbia and earned a graduate degree in philosophy from Tel Aviv University. It was founded in 2005 in Ramallah. It has never been clear whether the external pressure that the leaders of the movement are trying to mobilize is aimed at ending the occupation or at ending the state of Israel itself. The attractions of BDS are understandable. The occupation has endured for more than 50 years and has grown ever more controlling, cruel, and intractable. The spread of Jewish settlements is unabated for the past 20 years, which means for anyone 30 or younger, it has been hard to imagine Israel dissociated from Ariel Sharon's swagger or Benjamin Netanyahu's smirk. It is still harder given the denial of Palestinian national and civil rights and the growth of Israeli theocracy for progressive young Americans to offer a rejoinder to the original Palestinian narrative that Israel is inherently a racist colonial project aimed at disenfranchising the Palestinian people, that Palestinian refugees should be able to return to their homes, and Israel as a distinct national entity should be dismantled in favor of a secular state, that Europe victimized Palestinians by making Jews desperate for a haven and giving them the land, a simplification that Tlaib echoed, albeit in a statement showing a certain compassion. Netanyahu's government purported to reverse its decision on Tlaib's case, announcing that she would be allowed to visit her grandmother, who's in her 90s, in Beit Ur al-Faqwa, a small West Bank town west of Ramallah, on humanitarian grounds, though only after the interior minister exacted a written pledge from Tlaib to respect any restrictions and not to promote boycotts against Israel during her visit. This pledge only added a measure of humiliation to the original offense. On Friday, Tlaib said that she could not, upon reflection, repudiate her right to speak out and canceled the trip. In a statement, she said, "I've experienced the same racist treatment that many Palestinian Americans endure when encountering the Israeli government." Trump then tweeted, "The only real winner here is Tlaib's grandmother. She doesn't have to see her now." In this context, and to the Democrats' chagrin, American progressives have been drawn into a simple contest about Israel's reputation, which can elide its realities. Whether on campuses or in Congress, the existence of the Israeli state increasingly looks to progressives, above all, like a civil rights violation on the world stage, like apartheid-era South Africa or Jim Crow South. BDS, for its part, seems to them a reasonable, nonviolent way to confront it. All Israelis, so the argument goes, are implicit in the travesty, while the United States has ingenuously nursed along because of a growing Israel lobby that cynically exploits the memory and legacy of the Holocaust. The time is long past, BDS advocates say, to make all Israelis hurt until they get the message. You boycott Israeli institutions and agitate for disinvestment from Israeli businesses or from global companies that partner with them. You agitate to sanction Israeli government officials and threaten to take them to the International Criminal Court. Led by communities of color, progressive Jewish groups, mainline churches, trade unions, academic associations, LGBTQ groups, indigenous justice movements, and university students, Barghouti wrote recently in The Nation, many Americans are abandoning the ethically untenable, progressive, except on Palestine stance. Barring American members of Congress from Israel is deplorable. What makes the move also counterproductive is that the best defense against BDS is to expose skeptical foreign visitors, such as Omar and Tlaib, to Israel's internal divisions, which will seem utterly familiar to them. It's comparatively elite, cosmopolitan, and frustrated Tel Aviv, coast up against poor, pietistic Jerusalem and the rest of the country. Time spent examining more Israeli realities might even persuade them that BDS is an unexamined, contradictory bundle because boycott, divestment, and sanctions are three very different things, hurting very different slices of Israeli society. One can imagine governments sanctioning Israeli settlement policies, much like George H.W. Bush did in 1991, when he warned that he would deduct any sum that Israelis spent on settlements from American loan guarantees. One can imagine international organizations setting telecommunications standards, sanctioning Israelis for hogging bandwidth from Palestinian telecom companies. But to boycott all Israeli universities or boycott all Israeli entrepreneurs, to disinvest from all Israeli companies or global companies that invest directly in Israel, all of these things will cut the ground out from under the very people who remain a crucial constituency for the kind of progressive politics that Omar and Tlaib represent and hope to foster. Indeed, it is the moral equivalent of the European Union boycotting Silicon Valley or Harvard in order to undermine Trump's America. Boycott the Hebrew University and you boycott scholars trying to bridge the studies of the Holocaust and the Nakba. Boycott Israeli chipmakers and you boycott companies setting up research offices in Palestine. If American progressives have a role, it is not to fantasize about collapsing Israelis' universities and economy, but to support Israeli progressives who, like Omar and Tlaib, are trying to reform their country. In both places, it will be a long haul. Make no mistake, it is an outrage that members of Congress should be barred from visiting Israel for any reason, and it is equally an outrage for an American president to encourage another nation to bar his political opponents. Imagine another beneficiary of aid, King Abdullah of Jordan, barring Representatives Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler for supporting resolutions that, in his view, put his kingdom in jeopardy. But outrage is Trump's specialty. Democratic leaders had better not underestimate the trap that his rants about Israel and anti-Semitism have put them in. Condemn BDS supporters, and you risk appearing indifferent to one of the great human rights issues inspiring the party's next generation. Soft pedal the perils of BDS, or even its logic, and you risk debasing the liberalism that inspired the past generation. What, after all, is the difference in moral attitude between boycotting a country and barring a boycotter from it? Trump may be wrong to think that American Jews, more than 70% of whom voted against him, will overlook the affront that his behavior poses. But Trump will not be here forever, and the trap will outlast him. The presidential candidate who does not flinch from confronting its complexity will be doing the Democratic Party and a Democratic country a service. This by Bernard Avishai. He teaches political economy at Dartmouth and is the author of three books, The Tragedy of Zionism, The Hebrew Republic, and Promiscuous. He was selected as a Guggenheim Fellow in 1987. Let's move on to the art world. From the August 26, 2019 issue, Renoir's Problem Nudes. An argument is often made that we shouldn't judge the past by the values of the present, but that's a hard sell in a case as primordial as Renoir's. This is by Peter Sheldahl. Who doesn't have a problem with Pierre-Auguste Renoir? A tremendously engaging show that centers on the painter's prodigious output of female nudes, Renoir, The Body, The Senses, at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts, sparks a sense of crisis. The reputation of the once exalted, still unshakably canonical, impressionist has fallen on difficult days. Never mind the affront to latter-day educated tastes of a painting style so sugary that it imperils your mind's incisors. There's a more burning issue. The art historian Martha Lucy, writing in the show's gorgeous catalog, notes that, in contemporary discourse, the name Renoir has come to stand for sexist male artist. Renoir took such presumptuous, slavering joy in looking at naked women, who in his paintings were always creamy or biscuit white, often with strawberry accents, and ideally blonde, that, Lucy goes on to argue, the tactility of the later nudes, with brushstrokes like roving fingers, unsettles any kind of gaze, including the male. I'll endorse that for what it's worth. Renoir's women strum no exotic nerves in me. There's no beholding distance from their monotonously compact, rounded breasts and thunderous thighs, smooshed into depthless landscapes and interiors, and thus no imaginable approach to intimacy. Their faces nearly always look, not to put too fine a point on it, dumb, bearing out Renoir's indifference to the women as individuals within her lives. They aren't subjects, only occasions. His models were often amazed at how little they recognized themselves in pictures that they had posed for. Peculiarly, Renoir did grant the women wonderfully articulated hands, the body part hardest to render convincingly, good for doing things, perhaps around the house. In his later work, his most prominent models were his servants or other lower-class women. He's great, though, according to the standard of art history, that values the refreshment of traditions by way of radical departures from them. The brilliant curators of the Clark Show, Esther Bell and George T.M. Shackelford, demonstrate Renoir's pivotal place in French painting of the nude by interpolating apposite works by such predecessors as Boucher, Corot, and especially Courbet, whose nudes are like libidinous four-alarm fires. By Renoir's contemporaries, the sardonic Degas and conscientious Cézanne, and by members of the next generation, notably Picasso, Matisse, Valadon, and Bonnard. The show is a romp for connoisseurship, illumining by abrupt contrast the core qualities of the respective artists. Picasso, adored and collected Renoir nudes. The more outrageous, the better. I think he responded to something about Renoir that he also found in the consummate religiosity of El Greco and the hieratic integrity of African sculpture. Downright, forthright art, uncompromised by social niceties and free of apologetic irony. A bit akin to what Kierkegaard wanted from God, the capacity to will one thing. Everything in Renoir that is hard to take and almost impossible to think about, because it makes no concessions to intelligence, infirms his stature as a revolutionary artist. He stood firmly against the past in art and issues a stark challenge to its future. You can't dethrone him without throwing overboard the fundamental logic of modernism as a sequence of jolting aesthetic breakthroughs, entitled to a special rank on the grounds of originality and influence. The more politicized precincts of the present art world are bent on just such a purge, and it's hard to contest their point by sticking up for Renoir's only too confident, even embarrassing panache. But there's no gainsaying his historic significance. Class is key to understanding Renoir. He was born in Limoges in 1841, the sixth of seven children of a tailor and a seamstress. The family moved to Paris 4 years later. He left school at the age of 12 or 13 to apprentice as a decorator of porcelain, quickly advancing to a mastery of Rococo forms and images. That training persists in all his painting, in which he centers the subject in space that goes vague toward the corners of the canvas. Meanwhile, he haunted the Louvre. Committed to fine art, he entered the École des Beaux-Arts in 1862. His schoolmates included Monet, Sisley, and Bazille. He produced strong works from the start under the spell of Courbet's audacious realism and Manet's celebration of urbane modernity. His earliest nude in the show, Boy with Cat, from 1868, isn't only rare for him with his male subject, but startlingly homoerotic. This was the era when artists started to forsake aristocratic and institutional patronage, bucking the bias of the annual salon while hungering for inclusion in it, in favor of support from a burgeoning middle class. In contrast to his better-off peers who chafed against their starchy upbringing, Renoir was bourgeois by aspiration, not by birth. Unconflicted, he swooned for the fashions and the pastimes of the new order in such touchstone masterpieces as Dance at the Moulin de la Galette of 1876, which is outside the purview of the Clark Show, the swirling crowd of chic merrymakers in dappled summer light has enticed innumerable youths, including me long ago, into a passion for modern painting. There's an anticipation here of Andy Warhol, who jumped from lower-class depths to upper-class heights, eliding the middle altogether. That social infatuation, plus the artisan roots of a style that bore traces to the last of ceramic embellishment, made Renoir an unprecedented artist type, no more but also no less vulgar than the society that gave him a life and paid him a living. He was a parvenu's parvenu. It feels wrong to term Renoir as a misogynist, although he was certainly patriarchal. Misogyny implies active animus. By all accounts that I'm aware of, including that of his adoring son Jean, his great film director, he got on pleasantly enough with the woman he married in 1890, Aline Victorine Charigot, a dressmaker almost 20 years younger, with whom he had already had one child and would have two more. And, with models, a mistress, and an illegitimate daughter born in 1870, whom he secretly supported for the rest of his life and with a bequest beyond it. He could be collegial with female artists, notably Bertha Morisot, but he gave no sign of regarding women as other than a specie subservient to men. He deemed women who performed professionally completely ridiculous. In a letter to a critic, he explained, "In ancient times, women sang and danced for free for the pleasures of being charming and gracious. Today it's all for money, which takes away the charm." The airy assumption in that may be worse than misogyny, which at least credits women with power as antagonists. It marks no mere flaw in Renoir's personality, but an essence of it that dovetails with his attitude toward painting. Sex and art figured for him as practically interchangeable rewards for living. An argument is often made that we shouldn't judge the past by the values of the present, but that's a hard sell in a case as primordial as Renoir's. At the show, part of me felt as though I were writhing on a pin. Again and again, the carnal tapioca, the vacant gazes, the fatuous frolic. Arriving at a cool Corot nude in a darkling landscape or a crisp Picasso nude combing her hair was like gulping fresh air in a miasma. The prehensile touch with which Renoir molds female masses with color instead of modeling them with tonal shading awes the eye, defeating a self-protective impulse to perceive the figures as if they were cells from animated cartoons. The work tends towards silliness, but never topples into it. He can really move paint around, and his colors attain complex harmonies, even as you may crave sunglasses to mitigate their screeching chromas. He's like a house guest so annoying that you might consider burning down the house to be rid of him. Let's not do that. This by Peter Sheldahl. He's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1998 and is the magazine's art critic. His latest book, Hot, Cold, Heavy, Light, 100 Art Writings, 1988 to 2018, came out this month. The next thing we have comes from the Annals of Gastronomy and is dated August 20th, 2019. And this has been all over the media, television, everything. The Popeyes chicken sandwich is here to save America. One day during 2017, during the brunch rush at Sweet Dixie Kitchen, a small Southern California restaurant that the Orange County Register once dubbed Long Beach's Church of Southern Breakfast, a customer was astonished to see a member of the restaurant staff duck into the kitchen bearing two large orders of Popeye's fried chicken. I wanted to believe that this was just a snack for the workers, but alas, it was not. The patron, who goes by Tyler H., wrote this on Yelp in an account of the meal. The chicken was instead destined for plates of the restaurant's $13 entree of chicken and waffles. When Tyler asked a server for more detail on how the dish was prepared, his suspicions were confirmed. The restaurant readily owned up to outsourcing its chicken frying to the national chain. Kim Sanchez, the owner of Sweet Dixie Chicken, who happened to be the Popeye's smuggler Tyler had spotted, doubled down on her decision in a response appended to Tyler's Yelp post. "We proudly serve Popeye's spicy tenders," she wrote, noting that her culinary philosophy is all about sourcing ingredients from the best purveyors, whether it's tracking down jam from an artisan in Alabama, finding fresh vegetables at the farmer's market, or placing a takeout order for America's best fast food fried chicken. After a modest media firestorm and a tsunami of jubilant consumer outrage, including inevitably a new Twitter hashtag, #PopeyesGate, Sweet Dixie Chicken took its Popeye's chicken off the menu and for the past couple of years, the restaurant has more or less chugged along without. That is until earlier this month, when for 2 full days, it was the only place in the world where a person could get Popeye's newest menu item, a fried chicken sandwich. This time, at least, the chicken was served with permission. The fast food brand partnered with Sanchez, capitalizing on the compelling oddness of hashtag Popeye's Gate. At Popeye's locations in Orange County, stores hung posters in the windows that read, "Chicken sandwich not available here, yet," and directed impatient sandwich seekers to Sweet Dixie Chicken. Sanchez herself starred in a peppy advertisement for the sandwich, in which she chats about her previous brush with notoriety and crouches to add the trademark symbol to a Popeye's logo drawn on the restaurant's outdoor chalkboard. During the throes of Popeye's Gate, I found myself surprisingly sympathetic to Sanchez's position. It's not that I was on board with the idea of buying one restaurant's food to sell at another, or marking up a $4 combo some 300% on the secondary market merely by putting it on a stoneware plate and throwing in a waffle. But it was hard for me to find fault with Sanchez's underlying aesthetic principle. Popeye's fried chicken is fantastic. The meat is flavorful and juicy, encased in a spiky golden sea urchin of batter. Surprisingly light, uncommonly crispy. Fried chicken is one of the world's great culinary syntheses, found in cultures and kitchens on every patch of the planet. Bird, flour, fat. American fried chicken, whose recipe was cultivated by enslaved Africans in the South, is at its best a food of transcendent deliciousness, an object of near holiness. There's almost certainly better fried chicken in the world than the version found at Popeye's, but only marginally so. And in most of the 49 states where Popeye's locations can be found, it's unlikely that whatever's better is more convenient or reliable. If you were going to try to pass off another restaurant's fried chicken as your own, and you had a Popeye's nearby, well, you could do a lot worse. The chicken sandwich that Sweet Dixie Chicken served for that 2-day tease is, as of last week, available at all 3,102 Popeye's locations in the United States. There are dozens of fast food chains in America, debuting hundreds of new menu items each year. Of these, maybe 2 or 3 in a generation make significant inroads into our collective culinary consciousness. A McRib here, an Impossible Whopper there. Perhaps the stunt with Sweet Dixie Kitchen wasn't even necessary. The Popeye's chicken sandwich has ascended to the pantheon in record time, not because of a catchy ad campaign or an irresistible pricing scheme, but because it is, if Twitter, Instagram, and uncountable blog posts and off-the-cuff reviews are to be believed, the best goddamn chicken sandwich in the world. For the past few days, my social media feeds, which most of the time read like bleak, polyphonic litanies of the falling apart world, have been overwhelmed instead by discourse about the sandwich. I've watched friends and strangers grow through the stages of enlightenment, skepticism, curiosity, anticipation, capitulation, ecstasy. It was specifically the ecstasy of Nia Raquel Smith, a scholar and food writer in Brooklyn, that pushed me out the door and into my nearest Popeye's. That Popeye's sandwich had me in my feelings. "That's probably the most emotion I've shown all year," she tweeted, and went on to enumerate its additional virtues. "The chicken is perfectly fried. The breading isn't falling off. You get crunch in every bite. The bun is a buttery cushion. The sauce takes it over the top. Is it healthy? No, but damn it, Don't it taste good? It's truly a gift from the heavens. Like Popeye's fried chicken, the chicken sandwich comes in two versions, classic and spicy, both of which are beautifully simple. They both arrive in a foil-lined bag. The better to keep the sandwich piping hot, its optimal eating temperature. They both have the same bun. As Smith promised, it's buttery and sweet and light. They have the same pickles, sizable rounds of cucumber crisp with vinegar. They have the same exquisite slab of chicken breast, hefty and juicy and snow white in its crenellated armor of that uncommonly crisp fried batter. There's regular mayonnaise on the classic. On the spicy sandwich, which to my mind is slightly better, the mayonnaise is spiked with cayenne. Both sandwiches stick the landing on the most important element of a fast food sandwich, the fusion of its distinct components into an ineffable, irresistible gestalt. The salt, the fat, the sharpness, the softness, together they're what flavor scientists might describe as high amplitude, a combination so intense and so perfectly balanced that they meld into one another to form a new, entirely coherent whole. This is not, as some outlets have reported, the first fried chicken sandwich to appear on the Popeye's menu. It's Chicken Po' Boy, a New Orleans-inspired offering of chicken tenders dressed with pickles, lettuce, and mayonnaise on an oblong French-style roll, was introduced nationally in 2003. But it has long since been discontinued, and the new sandwich has eclipsed its memory already, giving Popeye's its first serious challenge to the chicken-on-a-bun hegemony of Chick-fil-A. For some diners, put off by Chick-fil-A's right-leaning corporate politics and widely known funding of anti-gay activism, Popeye's appeals as a chicken sandwich with less overt moral compromise. The Advocate, the LGBT interest magazine, ran a story about the sandwich under the headline, "More Flavor, Less Homophobia." The brands, as is their wont these days, took the battle to Twitter. Chick-fil-A protested, oddly, that its version equals love. In response, Popeyes asked Chick-fil-A, "Y'all good?" Wendy's, whose spicy chicken sandwich really is pretty great, especially if you order it with extra pickles, jumped into the fray to assert its own poultry dominance. The rest of us can watch the mega chain spar, jockeying for the love of some abstract ideal of a sarcastic Gen Zer or whoever it is they think they're performing for. But these things aren't decided in memes. They're decided in months. Just a week after serving as the launch pad for Popeye's sandwich, Sweet Dixie Chicken closed its doors. The Long Beach Post reported that Sanchez transferred ownership of the restaurant on August 18th and that its future is unclear. Whatever the new management team does with the space, I hope it doesn't make the mistake of frying its own chicken. This is by Helen Rosner. She's the New Yorker's roving food correspondent. In 2016, she won the James Beard Award for personal essay writing. Now we've got some briefly noted book reviews. Look at your public library or on sources like Amazon to see if there aren't readings of these books. The MVP Machine by Ben Lindbergh and Travis Sawchick, published by Basic. The Moneyball Revolution in Evaluating Baseball Players had little to offer on improving performance, but the authors of this engrossing book follow the pitcher Trevor Bauer as he uses high-speed cameras and radar tracking to hone his physical gifts. In order to make the ball move more in the air, Bauer analyzes its path the instant it leaves his fingers and studies a principle in fluid dynamics called the laminar effect. The pitch he develops, the laminar express, makes him a star, and the league's best teams have copied his techniques. The Red Sox now travel with force plates to study the kinetic change of a player's swing. One thing you need to know in addition, that book, as I mentioned, is about Trevor Bauer. And on July 31st, in a big, big multiplayer trade, he came to the Cincinnati Reds. And he's been doing very well right there. Okay, let's go on. Our next book is A History of the Bible by John Barton. It's published by Viking. In addition to laying out the historical context in which the Old and New Testaments were created, this stimulating study considers how they may have been read, taught, and lived by believers. Barton examines the many ways in which various faith traditions have sought to reconcile their doctrines and practices with Scripture, and shows how its complex textual evolution can frustrate such attempts. Arguing that an exact fit has never been achieved, he critiques both fundamentalist readings, whose strict literalism he calls an abuse, and liberal doctrines that neglect the text. He proposes a nuanced approach that seeks to give the Bible its due without asking too much of it. Now we have EEG by Dasa Drnjic, translated from the Croatian by Celia Hawksworth and published by New Directions. In keeping with its title, the mastery final novel by Drnjic, who died last year, suggests a brain scan of its narrator, a dying author and psychologist. He sips through his life and associative digressions, encompassing case studies of patients, family members, and the fates of those caught up in the atrocities of the 20th century. Drnjic intersperses her fiction with documentary material, photographs and court transcripts, declassified documents on Nazi collaborators who lived with impunity during the Cold War, a tally of items plundered from Jews in Zagreb. Wars are an orgy of forgetting, the narrator observes, and Drnjic writes with an unflinching commitment to bearing witness. Every name carries a story, and history remembers the names of the perpetrators, not the victims. And finally, we have The Organs of Sense by Adam Ehrlich Sachs, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. The protagonist of this unconventional novel is the 16th century polymath Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. In 1666, Leibniz is 19 and has inexplicably just been denied his doctorate. Although shaken in his sanguine rationalism, he remains an assiduous inquirer into miracles and other aberrations of nature. When he hears of an eyeless hermit who, alone among Europe's astronomers, predicts a total solar eclipse, Leibniz makes an arduous journey to ask, "How did you come to lose your eyes, and how do you claim to see the stars without them?" Sachs confidently fictionalizes history, infusing the process of scientific discovery with dark absurdity. To close out, we're going to look to Andy Borowitz and see what sort of satirical comments he has to make now. Denmark offers to buy the U.S. Copenhagen, after rebuffing Donald J. Trump's hypothetical proposal to purchase Greenland, the government of Denmark has announced that it would be interested in buying the United States instead. A spokesperson for the Danish government on Friday said, "As we have stated, Greenland is not for sale. We have noted, however, that during the Trump regime, pretty much everything in the United States, including its government, has most definitely been for sale. Denmark would be interested in purchasing the United States in its entirety, with the exception of the government, the spokesman added. A key provision of the purchase offer, the spokesman said, would be the relocation of Donald Trump to another country, to be determined, with Russia and North Korea cited as possible destinations. If Denmark's bid for the United States is accepted, the Scandinavian nation has ambitious plans for its new acquisition. We believe that by giving the U.S. an educational system and a national health care, it would be transformed from a vast land mass into a great nation, the spokesman said. Now, apparently, an endangered polar bear demands face-to-face meeting with Trump. This from Washington. One day after the White House took steps to weaken the Endangered Species Act, an irate polar bear has demanded a face-to-face meeting with Donald J. Trump. The bear, who was described as livid by his spokesperson, has already begun his journey from the Arctic to Washington to express his deep satisfaction with Trump. The bear's spokesman said, "He's been ravenously hungry because of the destruction of his habitat. The latest news about the Endangered Species Act has not improved his mood." Although it is unclear whether a one-on-one meeting between Trump and the aggrieved bear will occur, a new poll indicates that a broad majority of Americans would strongly favor such a meeting. The White House has, so far, issued no response to the bear's request, but the Vice President, Mike Pence, has already refused a one-on-one meeting with a female polar bear. And finally, also from Washington, a furious Donald J. Trump has demanded that Facebook investigate why a status update posted by former President Barack Obama on Monday has received so many likes. Speaking to reporters on Wednesday morning, Trump said that the more than 850,000 likes that Obama's post had garnered as of Tuesday night were phony and called the seeming popularity of the post a rigged hoax. He said, "There's absolutely no way that 850,000 people liked Obama's post. I know a lot of people and absolutely none of them like Obama." Trump said that in addition to investigating Obama's likes, he was demanding that Facebook remove several hundred thousand of Obama's likes and, quote, "give them to me instead." Calling the former president's Facebook post as long and boring as a book, Trump slammed Obama for being terrible at social media, which is the most important part of a president's job. In that post, he uses words like motivations, proliferate, and unequivocally, Trump said. How could 800,000 people and more like a post full of words that no one has ever heard of? All this by Andy Borowitz. He's a New York Times best-selling author and a comedian who's written for The New Yorker since 1998. He writes The Borowitz Report, a satirical column on the news. And that is about all we have time for this week. I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This has been The New Yorker Hour, and I'll be back again with you next week. Till then, bye-bye.